Welcome to The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Mark Clausen, CEO of Diamond Rental. Once the domain of relatively small mom-and-pop shops, the event rental business has now grown up. It's now highly sophisticated, and nationwide it brings in over $5 billion a year. One of the best-run regional players in the whole country is right here in Salt Lake City. Mon Peterson and Lauren Winiger started Diamond Rentals in 1980, and they ran it for 20 years prior to selling it to Mark and his partner in 2000. To run Diamond Rentals, Mark left a promising law practice at one of the top law firms in the whole country, Wilson Sonsini. To put this in perspective, this is the law firm that took Apple Computers and Google public. And remember, Mark left at the peak of the dot-com era. His law partners must have thought he was crazy, but Mark knew this was something he had to do. He's been at the helm of Diamond Rentals now for nearly 15 years, and while Diamond Rentals is not yet the next Google or Apple, Mark has led the company through some pretty spectacular growth of its own right. Mark, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Happy to be here.
So most of our listeners have heard of Diamond Rentals, certainly seen their trucks around town, but just briefly, tell us what Diamond Rentals does.
Yeah, well, so we do event rental, so party and event rental services in one division. And that's everything from a backyard party to a large public event, a Greek festival or a state fair. And then, you know, we can talk more about those market segments. But it's a wide variety of things that we do. And interestingly, we also have 10 equipment rental locations across the Wasatch Front. So we do construction equipment from locations. And that's more of an area-based business. So that's, Utah County, Weber County, Salt Lake County, and we're also in Summit and Tooele.
Got it.
Davis County as well.
Let's talk about how you got into the industry. In the introduction I mentioned, you and your partner bought the company in 2000. And I'm sure, there's a lot that's going on as you're closing the deal, right? You're dealing with intermediaries. Yeah. You're dealing with attorneys, which you're very well versed in. And then the deal closes. The money hits the bank, and the next day you and your partner are running Diamond Rentals. What was that transition like?
Yeah, it's a funny story because there's a whole prelude to that, raising the search fund, which is an interesting story.
We'll circle back to that later.
But day one, I've always thought was kind of funny because as it happened, Troy had a pre-planned, my partner at the time had a pre-planned mountain biking trip. So on day one, I was there alone, and we had closed. It had been a death march, as you're kind of talking about, in conference rooms with accountants and attorneys. And we had this dream that we were going to get investors and buy a company.
And sometimes these deals fall through at the last minute, so it's a lot of pressure to make sure
it
actually closes.
This even had some hiccups, that pushed it back a few days. So on day one of owning the company, I still remember walking up the stairs into this corporate office that still is above our main party rental facility. So, and everybody came out of their cubes, and not everybody being five or six people. It wasn't a huge staff. But they came walking out and looked at me, and they kind of said, "Now what?" And I looked back and I said, "Well, we do all the same things we did yesterday. We still pay our bills. We're going to have a new bank account for that. So a guy said, "Well, payroll is this week. What do we do?" And I said, "Well, we're still going to pay payroll. So go ahead and prepare that. We're still going to need to buy things." This was right as the season. It's a highly seasonal business too, and that's another interesting topic of how to manage one of those. But right as just everything's turning on, all the switches that have been flipped off for the winter are flipping on. You got to buy a lot of stuff. You have to hire a lot of employees. You have to handle just a lot of nuts and bolts, logistical kind of things.
And did the previous owners stay for a while to help with the transition?
Yeah, they did. They agreed. They were. Okay. It was a really, and that was a good thing. In the search fund world or the world of these small acquisitions, a lot of times it's not that way, and it can get contentious. And we had one guy. An intermediary that was helping them sell their business, and he had suggested that one of the partners kind of step aside and be less involved because he had been very involved, kind of controlling about the business, and that he suggested that the other guy kind of stay on. And he wound up staying for a couple years, and the role was diminishing. He's come back in more recent years, almost like out of retirement, just because he was bored and wanted to do stuff.
Nice.
And so that's been a good thing. We've made it a good place to work, I think. But But it was kind of, it was good that they were around to answer questions, but it's also super awkward if you've been, I think there's one set of skills to build a business from scratch. You know, to go, well, what they had done with an equipment store in the first place was just open up. They got an old, I think it was a garage or a service station, and they started buying equipment and hung out a shingle, basically, like, we're a rental place.
Right, right.
And that, you know, they, that there's a set of skills to do that with, it requires a lot of gumption, and just, you just have to make it work. And then there's kind of a different set of skills once a company gets a little bit bigger, and sometimes they're not compatible, you know. Sometimes the things that you did really well when it was a tiny company and when it was just starting up are not the same things that you need to do when you've got dozens or maybe, you know, hundreds of employees. And so there was a natural transition where they were ready to move on, but really helpful. There was no obstruction. There were, you know, they weren't throwing hand grenades at new
management. Sometimes can be an issue.
Very frequently is an issue.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Mark Claussen, CEO of Diamond Rentals. So your partner had a previously planned mountain biking trip. So he was gone for what, like a week or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, he's gone for at least a few days.
All right, at least a few days. Then so now you're there. You've kind of talked to everybody. Now your partner comes, and it's behind closed doors, and you guys are like, what were those conversations like? You know, the conversation you can really only have with the partner that brought you to the table.
Right, right. And I think, it's worth mentioning that a lot of people have done deals like this alone, and it's very solitary, and then other people have done it kind of with a partner. There were things that can get weird, but doing it with a partner was really helpful for the very reason you talk about. You've got somebody that, when the issue comes up, you can directly bounce it off somebody. You don't have to call up a board member who's, you know,
maybe also an investor that
who's an yeah,
that's
yeah,
a little weird as well, awkward as well.
Yeah, it's
in
more,
its own right.
Yeah, it's a more direct and more helpful conversation that you can have right then. But we, just to answer your question, we started trying to figure out, well, what is our style going to be? Because there's the textbooks. There's the things you read about in a book.
And there's not a lot of those textbooks in law school. You guys were both law students.
We were both right. Lawyers. So, yeah, admittedly, we also hadn't really had a previous experience where we were, working in the division of a multinational or something. So we would have been exposed to a lot
of management.
So
it probably sounds a little crazy to folks in the audience hearing kind of your background. Now you take over the business. Now it's the two of you. And you've got some background with your family having run a business, so
right.
You got some experience that way.
Right.
But somehow it worked.
Yeah.
And you guys, you move forward a couple months. You saw opportunities for growth. You started thinking about, okay, this is a good, stable business. Job one is don't mess it up, right?
Yeah,
keep the
right.
thing running. Keep everything that is working. But you see some opportunities for growth, and you realize you need some help on the operations team, and you hire a gentleman, Leonard Cedillo. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yeah.
And he was a well-known operator in the industry. He had previously worked at A1 Rentals and Rentax, big firms. He was in New Mexico. How did you end up with the first key hire? The first couple hires are really important to get right.
Yeah.
How did you end up with him, and how hard was it to convince him to come up to Salt Lake City?
Well, probably serendipity is part of it. And we had started by, you know, I think it's important to note, we had started by, when I was talking about our style in managing, we started by talking about the HP way of management by walking around. And we really did immerse ourselves in the day-to-day. I remember spending time at our Kearns equipment store just on a Saturday morning, loading tillers into people's cars and kind of getting a feel for what the business was. I actually don't think it would have gone very well for us if we hadn't really understood the business. So then, because we did, there's probably some goodwill built up with employees and with other people. So the way Leonard came to us was part of that goodwill, because one of the former owners, and actually Leonard had a parting of the ways with his former employer, so he was looking for a job, but he wanted the credibility of somebody telling him, hey, you know, this is going to be okay. So we had him come up on we heard that he was available. He was connected with us. We spoke on the phone. We knew he was an operator on the equipment side. He wasn't the party side, and that was the side of our business that was suffering more at the time.
I'm guessing back in 2000, there was still a lot of technology that was not implemented in Diamond Rental.
Yeah.
Right. At the time, you know, you and I knew each other in 2000.
Yeah.
It seemed like the world, boy, that was the internet was booming. It seemed like we were pretty technologically advanced.
Yeah.
Were there major technology solutions that you could bring in to help with this complexity, or did you pretty much just keep the same systems?
Well, we were forced to upgrade in part, but it didn't radically change. They had a software system which was, it looked like probably what you or I would remember from a library software system in the 80s or 90s where it's
DOS-based,
and you've got the flashing cursor.
Exactly.
And
okay, that's what I'm thinking.
A green or an amber screen, and you can enter stuff in. So these guys had done that, the former owners. They were up to that system. As I always joked, it was the year 2000, and I was like, okay, we're going to spend some money and bring us into the 90s. but it was, and you can't say that technology really made a huge difference, but we were forced because the company that was the provider for that particular software system was actually going out of business. So we were forced in the opening months to do something. And the server that we had, I was amazed the company was being run on a server that looked kind of like a really old Dell desktop, you know, and we called it Frankenstein. The cover had been removed, and it looked like it had whirling bells.
In the brains of the whole operation.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at that thinking, okay, where's the redundancy if there's a server crash? There's really none.
Right.
You know, somebody would be physically taking a hard drive and trying to, you know, bring it back to life in a lab someplace. So we wound up buying, changing software vendors, getting a new system, and that had its own pluses and minuses. In a small industry, without a lot of technical savvy, there weren't really great products that were out there. So also not having tremendous resources, being a kind of a small company, we worked with what we could. So we got a better product, started running reports, and to the credit of the former owner, the culture really was built up on some good metrics, making sure that the utilization of the assets was in
key.
An acceptable range. And
key in a rental business.
It's the heart of the business, yeah.
Let's take a quick break, then we'll talk some more with Mark Claussen, CEO of Diamond Rental. Welcome back to The Bottom Line at KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Mark Claussen, CEO of Diamond Rental. So let's talk some more about building a team. You got to work with several interesting tech darlings in your time as an attorney at Wilson Sonsini. You're in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting time to be there, but this question has more to do with, were you able to see or were you able to glean from the CEOs of the companies you were working with kind of some best practices on building teams? Was that a valuable experience for you?
You know, my experience in Silicon Valley was not, I wouldn't say that I interfaced with the operational side of businesses very much. So one of my decisions, in fact, it's interesting because my answer to your question is probably more based on why I chose to leave. I mean, it probably results in the analysis of why I decided mm-hmm. to leave Silicon Valley.
Well, let's talk about that.
Because my limited interaction would have been during the course of a company going public or maybe in a merger transaction, I'd interface with the more senior management. And it felt so much like, for me, now, granted, I would have made a lot more money and you know, maybe prestige or whatever if I would have stayed down there. But it felt like smoke and mirrors, kind of. Silicon Valley
It
didn't pull me in.
But yet it is necessary work, right? I mean, all these things that you did, unfortunately, the world we live in requires these kind of documents for a company to get bought or
sold. I'm not even talking about practicing law for them. I'm talking about just the companies themselves. So if I'm talking to VP of sales for, a Salesforce automation company,
right?
A lot of times it felt like, well, they're selling vapor to everybody's involved, and there is an actual product in there, but it didn't feel real to me somehow.
And it takes all types, right?
I mean,
that for other people, that's kind of like, wow, that's the dream, that's the excitement.
Oh, it is the dream, and the money. In fact, Steve and I always talk about that because, you know, of his experience at Tenfold and a couple other companies, that it's a different type of person that becomes a very, very high-powered salesman at a big software company. The fortunes are there to be made. And getting back to your question on building teams, if it didn't feel like a natural fit with me in a way, because I've been in it a lot longer than
you can
I ever
touch
planned.
It, you can feel it, you can see it, your customer uses it, you can see the impact of it.
Yeah, and the people involved in it are a little more real. So it was a good fit with me. I actually like sort of, real people, salt of the earth people. Yeah. That's the people that tend to gravitate to a business like Rendell.
Well, I saw a quote.
And I like that.
Yeah, I saw a quote. It might have been the same Wall Street Journal article where you said that something just didn't seem real to you about the work you were doing. And it's alluding more to the industry and not the law side of it, but really just kind of the whole ecosystem out there.
That's probably what I was talking about. And at the same time, I could do it, but I didn't really love spending days, weeks, or months drafting a complicated agreement because it's a skill that I had, but it taxed me. And I always had a goal to not I'm sure like you and many other people, I didn't want to do something where I woke up every morning and my first thought was, oh, I got to go there.
Exactly.
Oh, instead I wanted to wake up every morning and think, oh yeah, okay, here's three or four things I want to get done this morning. And then that powers you out of bed and you get in the shower and then you're driving down the road a few minutes later. And that was the way I wanted to live my life. And I didn't feel that way working around technology and practicing law, frankly.
Got it. Well, there must have been in the law side of things something that you really loved because you went back to get your, it's not a PhD.
JSD, yeah.
The JSD.
It's like a PhD.
It's a PhD for lawyers.
Yeah.
In law history.
Yeah.
So what was it about law that attracted you? And was there something that came along that said, you know, actually, I don't want to spend my, it's not my life's work. What was the moment that said, this is not my life's work?
That's interesting. Well, I did like the study of law, and I like the analysis of it. I remember hearing a university professor who was a lawyer, I mean, a university president, talk prior to going to law school, and he basically said, you know, if you like the building blocks that society is made of, if you read the paper and you're interested in these events happening, you'll probably enjoy law school. And that was one of my, I really liked that idea because I did. I like understanding how things are built and what the structures that we all take for granted, you know, where they come from,
right?
Whether it's constitutional or statute driven or whatever. That was interesting about law school. It wasn't as interesting once I started practicing. So for me, I wound up getting, I had a relationship with a professor at Duke who suggested that I talk to a friend he knew at Stanford. So this guy, he basically was saying, hey, when you're out there, I know the things you're interested in, maybe you ought to talk to this guy. And the guy at Stanford, when I'd been practicing law for about a year, I think out of boredom, I made my way over to the Stanford Law School one afternoon and wound up looking up this colleague of this friend of mine that was a law professor. And within about a week, he had suggested and I had essentially been admitted into this doctoral program. So
which is full-time, right? You had to give up your law practice?
I gave it up, but only for like 3 months. I had the best of both worlds to tell you the truth. I went back and was part-time at Wilson Sonsini. So the firm was extremely accommodating. And I also got married that summer. So I got married, quit my job, and started the doctoral program all within a matter of weeks. And then I wound up back in Palo Alto, needed to make some money, talked to my old contacts at Wilson, and they said, yeah, sure, you can work part-time. So I started doing part-time deals. Did that for 2.5 years maybe while I was writing my dissertation. And then I went back and was full-time at Wilson again for 2 more years.
Interesting.
While I tried to figure out what I was going to do when I grew up. But the real justification for doing the JSD was that I was considering being a law professor. So I thought that might be a good... That might be a good fit because I really
are there
do
days
enjoy
you wish you had gone that route when things are getting really crazy.
Oh yeah, sure. Think always. I've talked to the schools here about teaching on an adjunct basis. I still might, or maybe even fly down to the Bay Area and teach a class one day a week or something. I mean that could work out eventually.
Sure.
You know, I still would like to do that.
So it sounds like Wilson Sonsini was very accommodating. Sounds like you have a lot of respect for Wilson Sonsini.
Yeah, it was a good firm.
I think you were at the helm at Diamond Rental when Wilson Sonsini, they kind of had a program there for a number of years where they branched out into other cities. And for whatever reason, Salt Lake City was one of the...
They had an office. Well, they were trying to go to technology hubs. So they went to Austin. They had, a Boston office. They were here in Salt Lake.
And that was really early to view, for Wilson Sonsini, to view Salt Lake City as a technology hub.
Yeah.
I mean, I think 10 years, a lot has changed, and we now... clearly are, but back then I was very forward.
Well, if you think about it, go back one kind of turn of the screw before that, WordPerfect was a client of theirs, and there were a whole bunch of startups that came out of WordPerfect in Utah, especially Utah Valley. That's probably the genesis for today's technology growth.
So while you're at Diamond Rental, they open up a branch. Did you use them as your attorney?
No, because they were so technology-based.
It
wasn't really necessary. And I think one of the reasons for them moving out of the local area was that there's a limited number of technology companies that are going to pay a high fee schedule in order to have the credibility of being associated with a technology.
Sure. And those were different times. I mean, they definitely were not looking for non-technology companies. And
my
entrepreneurial venture, actually Wilson Sonsini, was my legal group.
Yeah.
And in 1999 and 2000, they called me up and said, hey, Doug, we need equity in your company. or we can't represent you anymore.
Oh, really?
And they I said, that's not going to happen. And they handled the transition very nicely. But it just shows you how frothy and crazy things got while. That, in addition to charging me whatever the hourly rate is, I think back then it was 300. It's probably triple that now.
Yeah, yeah. Because what you're paying for.
Equity.
Yeah, you're paying for, if you're a tech company, you're paying quite a bit and giving up a little slice of equity probably to get the right introductions. But for me, Wilson did represent me, but it was because a friend of mine that was a partner did it on the cheap.
Got it.
And so.
Okay. Well, we digress a little bit. Yeah. Let's go back to Diamond Rental.
company. It was time for new blood. And so we had a great growth spurt through 2007, and the initial investors did, you know, phenomenally well. But then how do we handle the downturn? Well, in 2007, we had just sold the company to another private equity group that heavily levered.
And we're going to circle back to that in a little
bit
as well.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, the nice thing is in the equipment business, you have a lot of assets. So we sold a lot of assets. We scaled the company down.
But
we closed redundant locations.
Selling those assets, other people are also, you're selling backhoes at the same time everybody else is selling backhoes into the market. So you're probably getting a very low price.
There's suppressed values, but there's kind of a market for that. And in fact, I remember going to a bunch of the auctions and you would see internet bidding and like, hey, okay, this group of excavators and backhoes just sold to Dubai. This group sold, so there was kind of an international market. So it didn't get suppressed as much as you would think. But yeah, the values are down. It's like a new car, you know, you rip the plastic off the seats and drive onto the street and you just lost a lot of value. Equipment is not quite that bad, but every month there is a definite drop. And there's kind of a quasi-blue book value of those assets. So the only things that we could really sell were, like you're talking about, rolling stock like backhoes and reach forklifts and excavators and skid steer
party loaders. Rental stuff you're stuck with.
Party, it's kind of worthless. Yeah. So, you know, if you think about it, what's the value of a table and some chairs? It's really nothing.
So how were you able to survive those years?
Well, one really big part of the picture is that the financial partners that we had in our second deal were extraordinarily good to work with. So it was the Prudential Capital Group. And they have a private equity wing, and they wound up being extremely patient, working with us while the company we bought a company with $6 million in revenue. We built it up to about 28 through acquisitions and, you know, green starts and just strategic decisions in the business. It shrank from about 28 down to like 16. So that
gets your attention.
Yes, and that happened over the course of maybe 18 months. So just a catastrophic fall off.
Right.
Most of that coming on the equipment side, because this financial shock was such an incredible shock to the construction business. So Party probably, we dropped an average of around 20%, depending on market segment. Because if you think about it, the state fair is not going to go away. The local sports teams, university teams that do things, that's not going to go
away. So the Party rental side is less cyclical than the equipment rental.
Probably based on the economy, yeah.
Really?
People are going to still
get married. Because I would think parties or something, you know, corporations say, you know what, we're going to skip the corporate event this year.
Yeah, and they did.
You're right.
That stuff happened. People still get married. But as one of our salespeople characterized it to me, and I thought this was like a very telling statement, at the peak of the downturn, he said, you know, when people were getting married a few years ago, they would come in and get 3-4 things, and they'd be adding, I want this, this, and let's add on that and that. And right now they're coming in and they're really questioning even the first two.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the fact is they still got married. So they probably did it, but at a scaled down rate. And then you can tell in frothy times that, you know, hey, but what's a budget? Little Muffy's getting married and it must be perfect.
Right.
So we're kind of in that era right now.
Our guest this morning is Mark Claussen, CEO of Diamond Rentals. The last question on kind of the operations and Diamond Rentals itself is, it's an industry where there's a lot of consolidation taking place. You must have been approached dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, to sell your business. Clearly, that's not in the works. If it was, you would have done it.
Right.
Have you thought about becoming one of the consolidators in the space and growing outside of the Wasatch area, the Intermountain area?
We have. We did actually a number of acquisitions in Boise and had a Boise party rental. A party and event rental facility for 7 or 8 years, and then ultimately we wound up just closing it, consolidating the assets back into Salt Lake, in part because the market was so competitive and fragmented up there that we didn't think anybody was making money, and it didn't justify being in business. We felt like it was kind of an exercise in futility.
You know, let me ask a little bit. I said it was the last question, but I fibbed. It's curious. What's different in Boise that makes it fragmented and less profitable than here in Salt Lake?
I don't know. You know, Diamond has always had a strong market position here. So on the party and event rental side, we have a strong market presence. But
which
up there,
has discouraged other potential competitors from coming.
Yeah, maybe. Their barriers to entry aren't tremendous, but it's also a really hard business. As I said earlier, very complex for the amount of money you get out of it. And a few national players, I guess I should get to your roll-up question. A few national players have tried to roll it up. There have been several. There was the Stellar Group in the 90s that wound up kind of with locations in most of, Ducky Bob's included, in most of the large market areas. And then Classic Party Rentals, which originally had been a search fund just like us, and with some of the same investors even, became a roll-up.
John Moran.
Yeah.
Is my memory right?
He was the founder of that search fund.
Right.
Yeah.
I think he's back in the party rental business.
He was a few years ago, yeah. And then did a East Coast-based roll-up and sold it to Classic during, you know, two private equity funds later during their roll-up. And what I would say, getting back to that question, we haven't really wanted to roll it up, in part because the complexities of running the different locations are greater than one suspects. So we haven't really had the desire to be in multiple markets. It also goes back to culture. We were talking a little bit earlier about some people that were influential offline. Bill Lazier is a former Stanford professor.
Right.
He was on our board for the first 2 to 3 years. Bill had a really, really strong predisposition against us doing a roll-up that captured a whole bunch of different markets. And that probably
what
was kind of influential
for
Mill.
I mean, he's very successful businessman in his own right. So
he is. And
his views.
And he actually had, at one point, he had businesses in Dallas and businesses in L.A., and he split his time between the markets. And he was really, and his point was, I've been spread thin in my life, and take a step back, and this is actually a key for understanding what we've done at Diamond, really. Take a step back and realize where you can spread yourself thin and where you can, and don't compromise on family and a few other things that maybe are really important to you. Mm-hmm. So lifestyle was really the big argument, and that's Steve and I, who have been really running Diamond together since, you know, he came in 2003. We both have the same feeling that I really don't want to spend all my time on airplanes.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to do that. And as a result, we've decided to drill deep into one market rather than go.
That makes sense. That's good advice. Thanks for sharing that. So let's transition now. We've been talking about Diamond rental business, the operations, building a company, running a successful company. But your background to getting to the company is quite a bit different than most of the folks that we have on the show. You were in your late 20s, maybe your early 30s. You and your partner decided that you wanted to run a company. You heard about something over at the Stanford Business School called the Search Fund. Tell us a little bit about what a search fund is and what about the search fund appealed to you.
Yeah, well, so I'd become friends with the guy that I ultimately raised the search fund with, and we were talking about how we both had a legal background. He was about to graduate from Stanford Law School. I'd been out for a couple years and was back at that school doing the doctorate we talked about earlier. So I was thinking, what do I really want to do next? So he actually was taking a class from the sort of godfather of search funds,
Irv Grosbeck,
sure. Over at the business school, and he. I remember we either went to lunch or got together one day, and he said, "Hey, you know what? There's this concept called a search fund." And I said, "Well, tell me about it." And he said, "Well, what you do is you get maybe some institutions, but definitely some high net worth individuals. They give you money, and you go buy a company." And I still remember laughing and ridiculing and say, "Oh yeah, and if they'll give me money, I will buy a company. I'll do that," because it seemed so ludicrous that I could talk people into investing in me and in doing what I really wanted to do. Because I'd been thinking about, I still remember actually, I had been online looking at some business brokers, and there was a chain of mountain bike stores over in Colorado in resort towns. But the problem was I had no money to put down to buy them.
Right. And that's a problem that. All young people have, right?
Yeah. And I remember looking at that and thinking, that would be such a great thing. That's exactly what I would like to, because I really like to mountain bike. So I would love to do that. I wish I could figure that out.
If only you had $500,000 to buy that business.
If only I had a chunk of cash, right. And I didn't.
So how does the search fund help you with that?
Well, the concept of a search fund is you're going to, a group of high net worth individuals and probably some institutions are going to take a flyer on one or two entrepreneurs. And that's why I think it seems so ridiculous to me that I could get people to buy into me as a lawyer doing this. But they're gonna give you money, a portion up front, and you're going to use that as living expenses. We raised $425,000 from a group of
investors?
18 investors.
So each one did $25,000, $30,000.
It was $25,000 units. Okay. And so
they're relatively small check sizes initially.
Yeah, and we had a couple that put in $100,000. So we had an institutional investor out of Boston and another ultra high net worth individual that kind of had an institution too on the West Coast that invested $100,000. Each one basically said, well, I'll do it, but I want 25% of your entity. I don't want to be just captive. I want to have kind of control. And that it wound up being an interesting thing to have that group of investors. It was a little unwieldy to have that many because some of them were put together in part by Bill Lazier, who made a bunch of introductions. And so we started going out and talking to these people. First, we put together an investment book. And we copied the format that a million other investors had, search funders had used before. But basically put our own resumes in it, talked about what we wanted to buy, borrowed a format, but essentially made it about us and what we wanted to do. We were lucky. We got some people that bought into it. The really serendipitous thing that's kind of crazy is at the time I had a part-time secretary at Wilson Sonsini, who had been assigned to me, I think, because we went to the same undergrad school. So didn't really know very much. I mentioned to her one day that I was probably going to be leaving in a few months and doing a thing called the search fund. And she said, oh, well, why don't you let my dad take a look at that book? And then she told me that her dad wasn't. Her dad was one of the usual suspects of these investors.
Really?
So I passed the book along to her. She took it home to him on Thanksgiving. He called me up in the office about, a matter of days later and said, hey, Mark, this is so-and-so. Can we talk for a minute? I said, sure. Shut my door at the firm. Right. And we talked. And he said, I usually don't invest over the phone until I meet you, but just tell me a little bit about you and what you want to do. So we talked for 5 or 10 minutes. And then he said, hey, you know what? I'm in, and you can tell all the other people that I'm in, and let's get this done.
Right.
So I still remember hanging up the phone and thinking, I can't, because a minute ago I had ridiculed my partner for suggesting that we could do this. And then I hung up the phone and thought, I can't believe this is actually going to happen.
Right.
It didn't seem real until then when we got the first commit of somebody to invest.
And so the search fund itself, that capital is used to fund a period of time where you look for a company. You mentioned you saw this mountain bike company and the resort. That's not a search fund type business.
No.
So that's not going to fly. But most people look for at least a year, oftentimes two or three for a company. And this capital gives you a salary, at least lets you pay your mortgage if you've got that, put food on the table so you can have a life.
And we were raising money in a time where nobody felt like we could get a deal done because the market was really hot.
Right.
So one way that we had to differentiate ourselves is I had grown up in Salt Lake originally. I'd been away for about a decade. And I think my partner had grandparents that were here. He had a connection. He and his wife actually really wanted to move to Salt Lake. My wife and I kind of wanted to stay in the Bay Area, but it was a much more compelling argument to say, look, we're going to go away from where everybody's competing for these deals on the West Coast and on the East Coast, but we'll go to another place, separate ourselves a little bit from all this and do a search for a company like you talked about in Utah and the surrounding states. So we kind of said...
So you had a geographic focus. What about an industry focus? Usually there's a handful of industries people identify ahead of time.
We didn't do that. We actually just said we're going to go and we'll have an office in Salt Lake. We'll probably look between Boise and Phoenix and Denver and maybe Reno. And we'll look for good companies that fit our criteria. And on the criteria were... it's not rocket science, but we wanted a service or non-technology-based business, I'll put it that way. We wanted to avoid distributors. We wanted to avoid manufacturers, things, and especially technology where we felt like we might get crushed by the winds of change, So as one member of our board put it very well a year or two after we had closed the deal, he said, well, I invested in this because the risk was on the entrepreneur, not on the company.
So it's a relatively small amount of money up front.
Yeah. So they're putting $25,000 in first for these people. That's, hate to say it, but it's kind of chump change.
Right.
So the company that we wound up investing, it seems like maybe every unit, so every $25,000 they had invested allowed them to put in maybe $250,000 into the deal.
Right.
So it wasn't, which is also
kind of chump change. By that point, they had known you guys for 18 months. They've gotten to see your work. Mm-hmm. And they got to know the bet was on the entrepreneur. In large part, it's still on the entrepreneur. It's got to be, the business is relatively easy to evaluate.
And it needs to be a stable business.
Right. The phrase I've heard used for search fund companies is, you want a company, if you use the analogy of a horse, where, you know, the horse kind of, it's a thoroughbred horse that knows its way around the track. We're going to change the jockeys,
right?
But the horse is going to do a couple laps for you on its own without much input.
Right.
Once you figure it out, then you can start giving the horse inputs. And I think that's a great
visual
to explain that. So now you guys are looking. Your search was relatively short. As I said, many of these end up being 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
How did you find out about Diamond Rentals?
Yeah, well, we were paranoid about running out of time. I think it was good to have a little healthy sense of paranoia that you might run out of money. And there really was no backstop for us because I'd quit my job and he hadn't taken a job out of law school. So we had that ticking clock propelling us forward.
And what did you think? You had money for 2 years?
We have 18 months to 2 years is what we kind of thought, depending on expenses and how much it cost to get a deal done, et cetera. So we actually relocated to Salt Lake, took a little office in a tiny underground place on Wasatch Boulevard next to a kind of underneath a real estate office, I think. And we just started looking. And as you said earlier, we weren't looking for specific industries. We were looking for trying to be opportunistic and find something that really fit our criteria. So we looked at a couple. We got some good advice from somebody that had done one of these before, and we made a couple attempt runs at businesses that maybe weren't 100% of what we wanted. But it was valuable experience, and we got, you know, one was in the telecom business. We got it under an LOI, really got a chance to look at the business, understand
LOI
it better.
Being a letter of intent, kind of, before you get in all the legal documents, just make sure you're kind of on the same page regarding terms, price, stuff like that.
Kind of a commitment, which allowed a more intensive level of due diligence where we could really scrutinize the industry and the company. And in that case, it turned out there were some real serious problems. And I think the investors really, there's a sense of credibility that comes from maybe pulling back a little bit. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my partner and I, we always joked that he loved every deal we looked at and I hated every deal. And I don't know if that was more.
It's important if you're going to have a partnership that's one of you are on both sides.
Yeah. And
both
I don't know
of you
if
you on the same side, that could be a recipe for disaster.
Right. And it was a good balance, I think. So we looked for companies. This one, after we had come across a couple, we were talking to brokers, we were looking, going to some industry conferences once we found an industry we liked. This one happened to be that my partner looked at the businesses for sale section in the Wall Street Journal, of all things. And I think they used to have a Thursday classified. I don't know if they do anymore or not. It's definitely not.
I don't think they do.
It's not in the online version.
I do remember that. Yeah.
So he wound up calling a guy and he called about a rental company in Texas. But the guy that he called, who was in Chicago, said, well, you're in Salt Lake. I mean, there's another business I'm selling that's in Salt Lake. So we can talk about the Texas one, but why don't we just do that? So within a day or two, we actually were driving around and looking at the Diamond locations and starting to kind of take a closer look at that business.
And what was your first impression? So the book that the broker puts together gives you a little bit of background history, some financials.
Yeah.
What was your initial impression of the business?
I think some things would probably hold true to this day. I felt like it was a little rundown. That was an initial impression. So that's not of the industry, but of the locations we went to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly reflects the fact that they'd been preparing the business to sell it for a year or two. And it felt like the morale was a little bit low, or, you know, you get these intangible feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But also for the business, I liked that in a way, because I felt like here's something that I can understand, I can improve. I feel like there's somewhere to launch this to, and that it's not peak performance and it's never going to grow. I also liked that it, to the extent construction grows on the Wasatch Front, well, let me put it this way, to the extent population grows on the Wasatch Front, both sides of this business are going to do pretty well, and it's likely to grow. And, you know, you pull up any online data published by this state, and it's robust population growth projections.
Big families.
Yeah, and that's actually likely to drive the business, which is a really, really good thing. So we liked that. There were some red flags too. Home Depot was just getting into the rental business. And so you look at a company, a big box store, and in the family business that I'd grown up, they were having a lot of competition from the big box retailers that had moved into the segment.
It was the lighting business that your family ran.
Mm-hmm, okay. Mostly residential lighting.
So and Home Depot was a big factor for
that. Home Depot and Lowe's had kind of taken over that market and were really, really hurting small distributors like I'd grown up in with my family's business. So I didn't like that Home Depot was getting into that, and yet there was a feeling that there's not 100% overlap. And this was the compelling case I made to the investors at the time.
And it's quite a bit more complex than selling residential lighting, as you point out.
It is.
And the complexity is probably, don't you think, part of what saved you from the Home Depots and the Lowe's.
Yeah, it's hard to do that. They can do a great job renting one piece that came is like practically a brand new item, came out of stock, and they put it in your hand and you take it home and use it for 2 hours. They can also stay open longer than we can really justify to keep employees there. So it doesn't, we're not going to stay open until 9 o'clock at night. And it doesn't pencil out. But the big box stores, and actually only Home Depot rents, Lowe's doesn't. But they can do things that we can't do. But at the same time, we have a broader offering. So I felt like there was room between Home Depot and the national consolidators. And you're overlapping with both, but you're not identical to both. So there's this little space, and we just attempted to exploit that space. Okay. Now, at the same time, the party rental was growing based on population and was doing it. That's kind of a newer industry that hasn't been around for 30 or 40 years. In fact, I think if you went back into the 70s, there were very few people renting stuff. In fact, I remember it was a little novel when I got married in the mid-90s. I was living in the Bay Area. I married somebody from Salt Lake. I remember going with her to help her return some stuff to this little company called Diamond Rental. That I had no idea 5 years later I'd buy.
That's funny.
And I remember it was a milk crate type thing of dishes, and I thought, that's what a funny business.
Yep.
What a funny thing that there's these people that have milk crates of dishes and they'll rent them out to you.
So I want to finish our conversation on the search fund because I think it's a really interesting model for folks.
Yeah.
So you raised $400,000. Now it's time to do the acquisition. Each person could put in $250,000. Some people did, some people didn't.
Yeah.
How hard was it to raise the money? Were you able to do it with just your search funders, or did you have to go outside of that circle?
We were able to do it with just the search funders. In fact, we were a little oversubscribed because there were a few people that...
You had the big institutions that wanted to write bigger
checks.
They
would have. They did. We actually felt like it was really good that we had a diverse base because the big institutions didn't get 100% power over our search fund after we had bought the company.
Right.
So if I had to,
and we're going to talk about that in just a second.
Yeah,
but before we're going to switch to the management bio in just a second. But before we do, I want to tell listeners, if you're interested in the search fund model, if you have a young person that wants to run a business, say, if only mom and dad had a couple $1 million, they could go out and buy a business. Well, most of us don't have moms and dads that can write those types of checks.
Right.
So the search fund model is definitely worth exploring. And you can, if you do a Google search on Stanford Business School, search funds, maybe even Center of Entrepreneurial Studies, they have all kinds of information on this. And it's a fascinating field for the right people where it's a match. Mark, you did that successfully. You and Troy are running the company. You decide now, you're going to do a management buyout. You want to buy the firm and use another group of investors to help you do that. Tell us what led you to want to do a management buyout, and how did that change the dynamics for you? How did that change your personal situation by doing a management buyout?
It didn't change the dynamics a ton, but the nature of the board changed, and the nature of I think that's like the biggest thing.
So the management buyout, you've got one group of investors.
Yeah.
And you own a relatively small percentage of the company.
Right.
And you do a management buyout, you're going to end up with another group of investors, but your personal equity stake's probably going to increase dramatically.
Yeah, increase quite a bit, right. Yeah. Yeah, so that was the goal. And I guess to answer how we got there was by about 2007, we'd had a great period of growth, and a couple of the investors, rightfully so, were feeling like, hey, you know what, we should take our money off the table here because this might be a frothy bubble. And so
people in 2007.
They were. And so I probably should have followed suit. If I had if I if I had my wits about me, that would have been a better move. But we wound up going from having a group of – by the way, we had done a couple other transactions during time. There were a few investors that wanted to be bought out, and we bought them out as they wanted to. And each one is kind of quirky and funny story. But we – by the time we got to 2007, we were down to about 12 investors. And then we'd done a recapitalization where a couple of the institutions bought out the smaller people. So that by then – it was going to be a great return for them, and management had to decide, well, do we want to stay on or do we want to kind of double down in this industry because we like it? So we wound up deciding, well, rather than taking everything off the table and just being hired guns, we'd rather be real owners of this business in that tangible sense that you take ownership over it and right. feel like it's yours. So that was a lot of the impetus behind that transaction. It also changed. I actually asked one investor in particular to stay on during that phase, partly because he had been on the board and was kind of like a mentor. I really trusted his judgment, really liked him. We were a little bit, to tell you the truth, reluctant to have just the new, wipe the slate completely clean and just have a new unknown entity. I wanted like a voice of sanity and reason.
So was it one investor you mentioned earlier, Prudential Capital?
Yeah.
Was it primarily just them that was going to be your financial backer at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. And I had really nothing good to say about them because we had to weather some very difficult times and they were with management. So as we, Steve and I, look back at that time, we realized, well, really the way we navigated through those stormy waters really was that we had somebody that was patient and reasonable and good to work with. And I mean, we like to think the same thing about ourselves, but when times are tough and the world is melting down.
That's when you find out how good your partners are.
Yeah, and no customer, suddenly the phones quit ringing and nobody's walking in the front door. And you know, that's when you find out who your partner's with.
Well, I'm glad they turned out to be such a good partner for you guys.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about the financial side of that and the structural side of the management buyout. I want to talk more about the personal side of that. There was a big personal decision, I would think, that you're going through. So this is, sounds like it was 2007 when you did that.
Yeah.
You and I are about the same age. So you're thinking, in some ways, you know, how do you want to spend the last 15 years of your working career? Maybe 20, you know, maybe we'll work longer than that. But those are important decisions that, you know, I think all of us go through. Was that important? It seems to me you had made your decision at that point that Diamond Rentals is going to be your life's work. Did you give a lot of thought to that?
I gave some, maybe not quite life's work, because that's it. I probably didn't want to paint myself into that box, to tell you the truth. In fact, the partner that I did the search fund with has teased me a few times. We spoke on the phone, and he actually said at one point, "Are you still in the same office, in the same building?" Because he left and did a similar deal in California. Then he left California, went to Colorado, and it has kind of moved around a little bit and done some different things. And for me, it is a little bit surreal because when we bought the company, to tell you the truth, my partner was always saying, "Well, I just want to get in a company and stay there and build it and create a legacy." I was more deal-based. And I think part of it is coming out of my law firm. I thought, I'd like to do a series of deals. I envisioned myself being in a search fund, buying a company, being there 2 to 3 years, and then doing another deal, buying a different company, being there 2 to 3 years. And I didn't really view it as a life's work. It's interesting you'd say that, because that to me, I almost felt claustrophobic when I thought about it in those terms. In fact, it's still surreal to me I'm running the company 15 years later.
Yeah. Do you think much about that, what your life's work is?
No. Well, to tell you the truth, this may sound weird or corny, but I don't think it's career based, because my family and my relationship with my wife and everything.
Right.
And part of this is maybe being philosophical, coming out of the Great Recession and coming out of the near death experience that we all had that were in businesses like mine. At some point I had to get philosophical 4 or 5 years ago and think, you know, I think, and I've got twins and then another boy and then another boy. So I have 4 boys. And I sort of felt like that's probably my life's work. So I got philosophical.
I don't think that's corny at all.
At the pit of despair.
I think careers are more enjoyable when you think of, you know, your life's work being your family and your career being an additional aspect of it. I think things get out of skew. And, you know, it's interesting because you and I both spent a lot of time in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I think those types of outlooks on life are not uncommon here in Utah.
Yeah.
Right, where it's family, and you want to have a successful career, you want to do interesting work, But you want that plus you want all these other things. You know, you want to have spend time with your family, do great things there. Boy, I loved being in the Bay Area, but frankly, I didn't like who I was when I was in the Bay Area because I was so one-dimensional. Here in Utah, I love the fact that I'm multidimensional, and I not only can say these things are important to me, but if you look at my calendar, if you look at the way I spend my time, if you look at the way I spend my money, I think it's all very consistent with these other things that I say are values of mine, that the other parts of my life reflect that.
Yeah, there's a little more balance. My wife and I have talked about this a lot because she was a professional recruiter in the Bay Area, and she's done that here as well. And we kind of laugh because she moved back here and managed the office of a national recruiting firm for a couple years before she left that, and we had our family. And now she's back working again once the kids were in school. But anyway, it was funny because people here would get at 5 o'clock, they would start saying, well, okay, I'm out, I'm leaving. And at first it was a real culture shift for Pam because she thought, well, wait, that's not what we do. Because we would meet at like 9 o'clock at home. I'd have late night dinner at my firm and then I would go home. She would be, you know, hammered. We'd arrive on the couch, watch a TV show for a few minutes and then roll off to bed because we were getting up at like 6 the next morning to go back to work. And it's kind of, you know, it's interesting the way that is. I totally agree with what you just said because it feels like there's a little, I like having a little more balance and the expectation not being that, you know what, it's all for your job, and if you're not willing to sacrifice 100% and destroy every relationship you have, then you don't have enough to be part of
balance,
XYZ
balance
software
company. Balance is important. As your mentor Bill Lazier said, you know, be careful, choose where you choose to be spread thin.
Yeah, and we have tried to do that even in our corporate office. We've tried to, and it's, you know, and there's platitudes and then there's reality, and sometimes I'm sure, you know, reality doesn't match, but we've really tried to make sure that people could take care of things.
I want to make sure we have time for an important topic to me. You know, one of the things we talk to a lot of the CEOs here about, most of which have started their company, I shared at the beginning, your route to entrepreneurship is different than most. You know, and my question to them is, what's really the risk of entrepreneurship? So here's Mark Clausen. He's at the top law firm, a place that people would die to get a job at. You risk that all to do something that was fairly risky to try, you know, to do a search fund. And people should know there's been many a search funds that have ended unsuccessfully without buying a company. What did you view back then as the risk? Gee, if this doesn't work out, could you go back to Wilson? And now, having done this for almost 20 years, including your search, now, how do you look at that risk? What advice would you give to the 25, 30-year-old lawyer at a top firm that says, you know what, this isn't my life's work. I want to make a change.
Yeah, you know, we named our search fund Rubicon Ventures because of the old story of crossing the Rubicon, that there was no looking back. And that was because Troy and I both felt like, well, we're leaving a legal career and we're not going to look back. Now, the reality is in a boom time, I could have gotten a job. But I did go back not long after the internet crash happened, not long after I raised the fund and we bought this company, and my firm was laying people off. So there wasn't really a soft landing pad in Silicon Valley after all. I probably would have thought there was one. But I think there's a big caveat to that, because for me, you only do something that risky if it's untenable for you to stay where you are. And it was just simply untenable for me to continue practicing law and staying there. I don't, for reasons I can't explain. I think it has to do probably with personality, with inclination, with my own perception of my skills and abilities, with what I wanted out of my life in the future, all these different things. I didn't really want to stay there, and it just felt almost compelled, like almost claustrophobic. I've got to escape this firm. I have to get out. This search fund seems like a perfect fit. I've got to do it. So I was willing to take that risk, even if the ship ran aground and I was looking for something. And to tell you the truth, I think that something would have probably not been practicing law in a conventional sense. Mm. And I may have fallen back on being a law professor and tried to scratch and claw my way into that somehow, because I had interviewed at some decent schools and felt like I could get an okay job there. But that would have been a more tenable outcome. It wouldn't have been the same type of thing as running a company, though. That's satisfying in a whole different way.
If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Mark Clausen, CEO of Diamond Rentals. Last couple questions. You risked a lot, as we talked earlier, to chase your dream of running a company. You know, the idea of being a CEO. You've now had that title for 15 years. Is being a CEO of a company what you thought it would be? And if not, how's it kind of different?
It's hard to say that it's what I thought it would be, because I think I went in knowing that I wanted to do something, but not knowing exactly what it would be like, if that makes sense. So I was kind of launching into the unknown. And so there was definitely a kind of a funny period where we were right after we bought the company, when we were figuring out, oh, this is what it's like. But 15 years later, would I do it again? You know, absolutely. You know, it's been a good experience. It hasn't, you know, the ups and downs, as I said earlier, I feel like personally, it's been rewarding. And you oddly probably learn more from the knocks upside the head and the times that the bike dumps you on the side of the road than the times that you fly down the trail and there's really nothing that, you know, runs into you.
Right. So, last reflective question as well. The last one was that way also. The idea of a partnership is an important question for anybody. You know, there's some people that, you know what, they're just wired. They should do things on their own. And there's other people that a partnership really makes a lot of sense. It sounds like you enjoy having a partnership. You had Troy, you mentioned earlier, and we talked about Steve as well, who you refer to now as your partner in the business. What advice would you give somebody that's thinking about bringing on a partner? How important of a decision is that, and how can they increase the likelihood of making a good choice?
I think it does require some self-reflection, that you've got to think, how much do you have an inner need to be kind of a lone wolf, for lack of a better way of putting it? Some people really need to feel like the idea is their idea, anything that's going to get implemented. I've seen that inside our company a lot of times, where somebody, they can't, and sometimes they've been good managers, sometimes they've been bad managers, but they usually it's bad, actually. But if you can't abide by somebody else having a good idea, then you better not want to have a partner.
In fact, you're not going to be able to grow your business very
much. No, you're going to be kind of stuck and mired where you are. So that, you know, the search fund itself, the search process we talked about earlier, I think is infinitely better with a partner. At least in my experience, that was really helpful, because the solid, and maybe it's because I like to think by talking through things and kind of exploring ideas. And when I verbalize something, I can kind of see it clearer, more clearly. So I think that's part of it. And I don't view myself as needing to have every good idea. And so if a great idea comes from somebody inside the company, I think that's great. And so if it comes from a partner or a collaborator of some kind, I think that's great. But I think that it can also be fraught with peril a little bit to always have partners, because while I just said all those good things, it can be frustrating at times too.
It's like marriage, right? I mean, I think at best it's the divorce rate in the country is about 50%. And that's what I see with partnerships too. It's about 50-50 if you're lucky.
Yeah. And it can be really frustrating when sometimes if you're a stronger personality and you don't get your way, that can be really frustrating.
My guest this morning has been Mark Claussen, CEO of Diamond Rentals. Mark, you took what many people saw as a fairly big risk to buy and run Diamond Rentals back in 2000. I'm thrilled to see it working out so well for you and your team. Thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss, with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.